This is Lori Grenier. You've seen me on Shark Tank. I'm always hearing from business owners who just can't get the money they need to grow. It's time for funding to catch up to the 21st century. It's time for Cabbage. Fill out the application online and you'll get a decision in minutes and could have access to a line of credit of up to $100,000. No waiting, no hassle. Cabbage is the real deal, A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau and twice a Forbes Top 100 company. So go to cabbage.com. That's Cabbage with a K, K-A-B-B-A-G-E, or call 888-CABBAGE.
Coming to you direct from the heart of New York City all the way to wherever you are, you're listening to the VIP Jazz War Report. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is going to give us some valuable insights in, quite simply, how to prosper. There are a lot of books around on making money, and while they're very good at what they say, there's one book that I've read from him, and it is simply brilliant. It's called Thou Shall Prosper. This book tells you how to develop the mindset, the attitude, and the action plan that puts you in a position where the opportunities to prosper start to emerge. It's a to-do list. It's a why you need to do it list, and it's a how-to list. And after reading this book, you know, I personally got a lot of what they call aha moments from it. And the irony of this book is that it's written by a man of God, a man of faith. He's been named as Newsweek's top 50 rabbis in America. He was the keynote speaker at the opening of the 106th Congress in Washington, and he's the author of many other bestsellers. He's the one, the only, Rabbi Daniel Lapin. Shalom, Rabbi Daniel.
Shalom, and what a pleasure to be on the Jazzwell Show. I really do appreciate it. And you know, whilst naturally my mother would have loved your introduction, even she would protest the man of God bit. I mean, we're all children of God, but the inaccurate implication that I am somehow a man of piety and virtue would rub her the wrong way because...
And your wife as well, I'm sure.
I just got too many speeding tickets for her liking.
Well, sir, flattery will get you everywhere. So I like the first half of your sentence.
Right.
Now, so many, you know, get-rich books out there. And yours has been very, very successful. What are you writing in the book where you felt that other authors are missing out on?
Well, I mean, you know, you said it yourself, of course. The get rich type of book really makes only one person rich, and that's the guy who wrote the book.
Right.
The goal here is not to learn a bunch of tricks. You know, it's a little bit like somebody who decides he's going to a city that has dangerous neighborhoods. You know, far be it from me to suggest New York. And on his way there at the airport, he picks up a book, Self-Defense in 20 Easy Lessons, and he reads it on the way there. And then, sure enough, late one night after he's been to a theater, he's on his way home through a quiet, dark street, and he feels a gun poking him in the ribs and an arm snakes around his neck from the back. And the guy says, you know, give me your wallet or you're dead. And he says, look, hold on a second. I'm pretty sure attacks from the rear were covered in chapter 17 of this little book I got. Let me pull it out of my pocket and I'll be able to deal with this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work like that. Life doesn't work in picking up a little bundle of little tricks because people are not there for you to manipulate. Instead of which, you know, God is saying, if you like, is saying to this guy, hey, idiot, you know, why didn't you go to the dojo or to the self-defense classes or to the karate classes for 5 years until you are so wrapped around the concepts that as soon as somebody attacks you from the rear, you explode into a paroxysm of violent response, jamming your foot down on his instep and sending your elbow into his nose.
Right.
But you can't do this by just buying a book and trying to memorize some tricks. That's not how it works. And Thou Shall Prosper is a book in exactly that spirit. It's not 5 years in the dojo, but it is saying, look, it's not just little things you've got to know. It's big things you have to become. You've got to start really liking people. That's an important thing.
That's an important
because
thing.
Because life's too short to do business with people who are bitten and grumpy.
Do you
so it goes.
But do you find that, did you ever get criticism
you know, being a rabbi or a man of faith, writing about getting rich, was there ever sort of people who sort of said that might be a conflict of interest?
Not really. You know, I mean, yes, there's some extremely wealthy people did criticize this, and mostly Jewish people, people of my own faith. I don't, you know, I think people who perhaps sort of not that comfortable with their own success, in some cases inherited wealth. But frankly, anybody who would say that there is an incompatibility between faith and between making money just really doesn't get it at all. Because, and again, you know, without going into the theology of it, the fact is that you do have to ask yourself, if you are a religious person, and many people in America are, they're Christian or they're Jewish, religious Christian, you know, those Bible-based people, people who take the Bible seriously, have to ask themselves whether the God of Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob planned for money to be a key aspect of human economic interaction. Or was God's attention distracted by some trouble spot in the Balkans? And when he turned around, he said, oh, my me, look what they've gone and done. They've created this horrible thing called money. You know, or was it part of his plan? So faith-centered people would ask themselves that question, and the book does answer it.
But one thing, I guess, where that sort of skepticism comes from is, like, a lot of preachers these days are extremely wealthy, the mega church guys. You know, they have their own private jets, and you've even got that reality show, The Preachers of Beverly Hills or something like that, where they openly flaunt their Bentleys and their Rolexes and things like that. Is that in your view okay?
Well, I've not had any personal interaction or exposure to the ugly side you describe. I just haven't. Now, I know many pastors who've got their own airplanes. Mm-hmm. I've ridden in one of them with him, and I don't see the. I mean, I don't see flaunting it, but it's perfectly open. I don't think, you know, most for-profit corporations are not run with as much public scrutiny as nonprofits are, because you can have a private corporation that literally has to disclose nothing at all, but religious and charitable organizations disclose a great deal to the public as well as to their funders. Mm-hmm. And so there are no secrets here, and I think everyone understands that these are people who are the CEOs, effectively the senior executives of multi-million dollar corporations. These are big, big organizations. I mean, you know that World Vision, for instance, on its own, dispenses more charity than any country in the United Nations other than America. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about very major organizations. And so for the CEO to want to avoid traveling commercial, frankly, I think anybody who can afford it should avoid traveling commercial and avoid subjecting themselves to the ravaging gropings of the TSA. So, yes, absolutely.
Now, getting back to your book, Thou Shalt Prosper, I really sort of spent the whole weekend reading it. And really enjoyed it. You know, and you've broken it down so well. And some of the chapters were, I think I had it in my gut, but the way you expressed it, sort of, you know, that's that aha moment where it's a gut instinct in me, and it's sort of hidden behind lack of, I guess, acknowledgement. But when I read your book, you acknowledge what I'm feeling, and then that sort of, that gives that aha moment.
Yes.
But from your book and from your wisdom, what would you say is the definition of wealth and definition of prosperity?
Oh, my. Okay. That's a really, really fascinating question. And I haven't had a lot of time, given a lot of time to think about it. But let me just try and give you an intuitive answer without sort of delving into it. I make a point that when I'm speaking about money, when I'm speaking about prosperity, when I'm speaking about finances, I try and avoid the situation of having people think, well, you know, there's lots of other forms of wealth, like, you know, good health and that wonderful family, and that's obviously all true. But I do pretty much confine, confine myself to finances and bank accounts is really what I'm talking about. So what would be a definition of wealth? That may not be necessarily the definition of a successful life, because I point out in the book there are four main areas that a successful life needs developing in, and finances is only one of the four. But looking at that fourth corner, looking at the wealth, I would say that wealth is a sum of money that flows in as a weekly or a monthly reminder that you are serving other people.
If I was if I was to ask you, in today's world, in today's time, in the year 2016, if someone follows your book, what's the sort of minimum level of wealth they can expect to attain? $1 million? $2 million? 20?
Yes. Yes, all of that and more. And let me explain. It's very much, it's very important to understand that the terms rich and poor are all relative.
Yes.
The term rich has no meaning, which is why I regard it with, utter loathing when politicians say the rich must pay their fair share. You know, people have to realize the flagrant dishonesty in that statement, because neither fair nor the word rich are defined.
That's why they use it.
Yes, exactly right. Of course you're right about that. So so the answer to your question of how much they can expect, typically, and, you know, the book has sold, thank God, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies, and I've received more than hundreds, more like a few thousand letters of appreciation from people who've described to me what happened to their lives as they began putting these principles to work.
Which story stood out?
Well, one of them would be the chief detective in a fairly small, mid-sized Washington town, not too far from Seattle, there was a rather famous high-profile murder in that town a number of years ago, and he was put onto it, and he worked for six or seven months. He worked these incredibly long hours. And he got overtime, but it turned out that the overtime pushed him into another tax bracket, and he ended up at the end of the 6 months of not seeing his family at all. You know, he ended up with the $75 extra for 6 months of work. And so he read the book and studied it, and then he walked in, quit his job, and started a business.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me a letter. Again, you know, it sounds gross, but it's one of the ways to get attention. You ask me the one letter that stands out in mind. This letter came with a $10,000 check to one of my favorite charities, asking me to send it in. And he said, look, when I had my job as a detective, I couldn't have given you $100, you know, let alone $10,000. But this is what happened. So the answer to your question is, I think it's reasonable to say that a person can expect to increase his earnings this year over last year, probably by 50%, 80%, up to maybe 100%. I don't think it's reasonable to say that everybody will suddenly get $5 million. It depends.
Right.
But generally speaking, to aim at doubling your revenue by applying these principles, that's reasonable.
Your book is listed out in terms of 10 commandments to gaining prosperity. But from a practical perspective, what are the top three things listeners need to do to start prospering?
Yeah. I'm aware of the seriousness of that question, because we've got listeners who are investing their time right now, and the goal is to make sure that they take something away of tangible value. So I'll do my very best to isolate out the sections from a long book in which I worked very hard to make certain there were no dull pages, no dead pages, no filler material, no puff material. Mm-hmm. The book is really filled with crucial information that everyone needs. But let me pull out the three most important things. I'll pull out the first one. I think that's an easy one. Look, advertising works. Right, we all understand American business wouldn't spend billions of dollars advertising. Mm. Google wouldn't exist. Facebook wouldn't exist. These companies all exist because of advertising. In other words, you can subtly influence people's behavior by bombarding them with messages. Now, you might say, I'm immune to it, I don't pay any attention to it, but the evidence would suggest that when we tell ourselves that, we're lying. The truth is, on some level, we're all influenced by what we read and what we hear. And the reason this is so important is because deep down we've all been bombarded with a socialistic message, mm-hmm. which is that business is bad, profit equals plunder, and that virtue equals or is analogous to poverty, or poverty equals virtue. So the idea is that if you've got a few dollars, you must have trod on the fingers of widows and orphans to have climbed up there in the first place. And we get it from entertainment, where the bad guy in movies is almost always a rich person or a bad corporation. We find that when they remake movies, like The Manchurian Candidate, you know, they've changed the villain in the original movie was North Korea and the Soviet Union. And the villain in the new movie is a corporation, like the Halliburton Corporation. So little by little, young people have been growing up subjected to this idea that making money is bad and having money is evidence of misbehavior. Mm-hmm. So I'd say the very first, most important thing, and I devote like 30 pages or more to the first commandment, which is learn how to believe in the dignity and the morality of making money. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't get that right, you're going to be pulling your punches. You're never going to be throwing a decent person. I'm assuming you're a decent person. No decent person will fling himself wholeheartedly into any enterprise that deep down he considers to be morally reprehensible. So that would be number one, I would say. Really got to work on that.
Right. Number two?
Number two, I would say number two is take the time to learn to read financial statements. It doesn't matter what you're trying to do. If you're trying to run a famous marathon like the New York Marathon, or if you're trying to lose weight, or if you're whatever you're trying to do, you've got to be able to apply a metric. You've got to be able to measure it. Otherwise, there's no way to test and train yourself. You've got to see how you're doing. And unfortunately, one of the tragedies is that among the many, many life skills that American high schoolers leave the 12th grade without ever knowing anything about is financials. So, and it's not that hard.
Okay.
It takes a few hours of work. You don't have to become an accountant. You don't have to be a CPA or a bookkeeper. But if you are beginning to, you want to start now taking your money seriously and you want to start growing your money. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about getting out of debt. You've got great people like Dave Ramsey who do that. You know, I'm not talking about how to invest because there are great people who will share that information with you. I'm talking about getting your grub steak together in the first place.
And number three?
Number three is probably the answer to people who object to my number two by saying, oh, I can't possibly learn to read financial. I just don't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
And number three is to stop watching television and YouTube. Stop devoting more than 10 hours a week that the overwhelming majority of us spend watching cats do stupid things on YouTube or watching, whether it's movies or sitcom, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
buy back some of your time. Stop allowing the culture to rob you of your most valuable asset. Take some of that time, use it to acquire skills such as mastering finances, how to read a financial statement, and then use the rest to start another business or to start a business or to do something else. But get back your life. That would be number three.
Okay, so advertising, so that includes an element of, say, promoting yourself, promoting your product, your service, that involves networking. And then number two is obviously understanding the numbers game, because numbers mean everything in business. And
yes, that's right. You've got to measure your own progress. You've got to be able to say, okay. And but it's very complicated today, because if you have a few dollars that is in a taxable security as opposed to one that's in a tax-free, you kind of got to know what the impact of all these things are. You've got to be able to weigh this up. You shouldn't have to go to a professional for the basic measure of how am I doing this month compared to last month.
And start finding time, which is your third one, on focusing and understanding and learning your craft.
Yes. Take back your own time. Stop allowing it to be robbed from you by the culture.
Okay. On page 3 on your book, you said, owing less money is the same as having more money. It's the necessary precondition for building wealth, which I found very interesting, because as a nation, we've been built on debt. In the last boom cycle, we were rich because of debt. So can you explain what you mean?
Yes. There's a very big difference between borrowing for consumer purposes and borrowing for investment purposes. If the borrowing is part of an economic plan, and this particular example isn't from me, it's actually from you, and that is, you know, somebody borrows money at a known rate of interest on a very specific market rate deal, and he uses it to buy a piece of real estate. And then in due course, the value of the real estate goes up, and he's able to either sell it at a profit and pay off the loan, or he's able to refinance it. This is all very legitimate debt. Borrowing in order to buy a car or to buy a vacation. By the way, this is becoming very popular in America today. People put vacations on credit cards and then take 6 months to pay it off or more.
Right.
So, yeah, that kind of debt, incredibly destructive because it's indulgent.
So basically you're saying act your wage.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
So if you can't afford a vacation, don't take one.
Yeah, you know, or make it a staycation, or take a different kind of vacation, but don't
extend your resources that have no return.
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
Now, I love this bit about the book. And this book, you know, goes back into this thing that the first step you said was advertising, and then I sort of expanded on it, and part of it was networking. Now, I've been told or made to believe that I should be networking at a lot of these business lunches and business breakfasts. And then along comes your book. And you,
I know what you're referring to.
you totally destroy and make it seem like that sort of networking is a myth. And you know, at first I thought, okay, you know, he's a rabbi, he doesn't know much about business, so I'll indulge him. But as I read more and more, you actually started shining the light. Now explain to us your version of networking, and the mic's with you.
Sure. Well, what I think you were alluding to are those meetings where they say, you know, it's a breakfast meeting the first Wednesday of every month or the third Thursday or whatever it is, and everybody comes along, and during breakfast they're sort of exchanging business cards and they're telling everybody what they do. Well, the truth is, and I've done quite a bit of research on this into the numbers, the truth is that many more times business is done, deals are transacted at Rotary clubs than at business development clubs. And the reason is because, for the most part, folks are at Rotary clubs because they're trying to, you know, help end polio in India, which is one of the things that Rotary did, or many of the other wonderful charitable things that organizations like Rotary accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I meet somebody there, I say to myself, okay, you know, this is a decent person. And so I take him seriously, and I think to myself, you know, this is somebody I should talk to about what he does, what I do, to see if we find some collaboration. But when I meet somebody at a business development breakfast, there's a venal component to it. He is there to look out for number one, himself. And he assumes that I'm there for the same reason. And so it creates a totally different dynamic, a far less helpful dynamic. Business is done at synagogues and churches. I think that's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing. But not so much is done at those kinds of things, because selflessness is a very important part of success in business. And it comes as a shock to people who hear that, but that's part of covering what we spoke about as the first most important thing about learning the dignity and morality of business. The truth is, business does not work by greed. No, it absolutely doesn't. It works by an obsessive compulsion to help other people. And yes, they will in turn dip into their pockets and pay you for enhancing their lives. There's no question about it.
So one of the key components,
the kind of networking that really works is to come out of yourself.
So the
because the most powerful correlation between with success in America is the number of friends you've got, the number of people in your life. And I speak about the importance of actually applying a metric to that. I believe in measuring everything. And I'm very serious. I'd say to people listening to us right now is, before you go to bed tonight, draw up a list of the names of all the people in your life who would take your phone call tomorrow. And here's the good news is it's not as many as you think, so please don't think it's going to keep you up till 3 a.m. It won't.
No.
You'd be shocked to discover how small that number really is. But once you know it, it's a great starting point. And you start trying to change that. You start trying to increase the number of people in your life who think of you as somebody trustworthy, somebody they like, somebody that they enjoy spending time with. You try and build up and increase that, because it's out of that that the opportunities develop. Now, a lot of people, I should tell you, a lot of people tell me, well, you know, I'm not a people person. I'm much more introverted. I don't hang. Okay, fine. I agree it's harder for you than it might be for me. But you have to get over it, just like you get over other things.
Part of business success is having something that you can offer that serves people. So this, you're saying one of the secrets to a successful business is servitude.
Yes. Now, again, as a rabbi, I say that's why the word service applies both to a worship service and also to customer service. Because the two ways of serving our Creator is to worship Him or also to serve His other children. And any father or mother knows how warmly and grateful you feel towards people who are good to your kids.
But at the same time, you know, on page 62, you said, trying to give people what they want only to get what you want does not work in the long term. So why is that?
Because of the cynicism. The fact is that if you are obsessed with providing for the needs and desires of as many as possible of your fellow human being, you don't have to worry about the money. It'll come. But to be focused on that, you know, it's a little bit of why it is that Dale Carnegie, who wrote a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People,
that's right,
died at his own hand. Now, why would he be so miserable and unhappy? If he knew how to win friends and influence people, why would he be so unhappy? And I suspect that the reason was that, in a sense, it's a trick. You know, Dale Carnegie says, here are some tricks for learning people's names, learning how to remember people's names, because that way, you know, they'll... Okay. But there was a cynical dimension to it. These are the things you must do in order to get those things. And the truth is that we are all very, very finely tuned insincerity detectors. Each one of us has that built into us. And, you know, you've seen it, I've seen it. You very quickly can pick up when someone's being insincere. In fact, it's one of the main reasons people reject certain politicians, because they pick up on the insincerity. And so developing a sincere love of human beings is such an important part of business success, because it pretty soon, after you've been practicing it for no more than a couple of months, it starts becoming part of your face. It's part of what you beam out to the people around you, and it's part of what other people receive and hear as a window into your soul.
So what you're saying is, if you ignore the what's in it for you concept, money will automatically come to you.
Well, as long as you do the other things as well. You can't just be a selfless giving person and then wait for it. No, you've got to find ways to actively be of service. And this is one of the reasons that throughout Jewish history, Jews have had and have carried as their last names indicators to what they do. It's like wearing your business card on your forehead. It's fantastic. So many Jewish names, many Jewish family names and last names were actually advertisements. They spoke about how they served other human beings. And you obviously do need to be. You've got to come up with something that serves other people, which is why I've always said that one of the worst pieces of advice that is given to school graduates is, oh, now that you're going out into life, you must find something to do that you love doing, and then you'll never work a day in your life because you'll love everything you do. Okay, well, you know, I mean, I love music, and I'd love to be a conductor of an orchestra. I'm yet to find anybody who actually wants to pay me to do it. And so the advice to me is, hey, you know what, find something you can do that you can do that is useful to other human beings, and go ahead and do that. Forget about what you love doing. That's selfish. Very nice, you want to conduct music. Unfortunately, that's not what other people need from you.
And then a lot of people would argue that if you love what you're doing, you're more likely to be good at it, but you're not falling for that, are you?
No, and look, there are people who are born with certain talents. You know, there's no question about it. There are certain people who, from the time they were young, knew that they wanted to be ballet dancers, and then there was me. And as desperately desirous as I might have been of wanting to become a ballet dancer, with the best will in the world, you know, me dancing looks like a drunk trying to step on cockroaches. So this is not a good avenue for me to go to, but it's probably a very good avenue for somebody who was born with that talent. But here's the thing I love, and that is every now and then I see an interview, you know, with a policeman or a commercial fisherman or whatever it is, all these people. And one of the questions that always comes up is, so tell me, if you had to do it all over again, what would you be? Would you choose another occupation? 99% of the time, they all answer the same way, which is, no, I do exactly the same thing. I love what I'm doing. They didn't pick it because they loved it. They loved it because they're doing it. And that's the really important thing. My advice to people just starting out is, no, don't go and seek a job doing what you love. No, do what you must do. Do what pays the best, because that indicates that it's of most value to most of your fellow human beings, and then learn to love doing it. And I teach how to do that in the book.
I loved the bit where towards the end of the book you said, learn to foretell the future. And, you know, I've read a lot of these get-rich books, and unless I'm mistaken, no one has this in their book. And, you know, two questions came up in my mind, because then I looked at examples like, say, Steve Jobs, who took the mobile phone into a smartphone concept. He actually created the future. And the other question I also wanted to ask you was, you know, what can the past teach us in predicting the future? So let's start with, can one create the future?
Yes, we definitely do. And let me give you an example. Part of ancient Jewish wisdom is that we have an obligation. Human beings are expected to be happy. In other words, happiness is not in any way considered to be part of the response you have to things that are good in your life. No, that's not what we do. We don't say, oh, well, if things are wonderful, I'll be happy. No, we say happiness is a decision I've made. Now, what's the reason? Well, not only is the happiness habit a tremendous gift you can give to your spouse, the people you live with, the people you work with, because it's horrible spending time with grumpy, whiny people. And so learning the happiness habit means that you are projecting a happiness around you. That is one of the key things to becoming a magnetic personality. People love being around happy people. And what happens when people like being around you? Guess what happens? Whether it's job offers or potential opportunities to participate in transactions or to be brought in on board, all of this flows from projecting a happy personality. And so, yes, that's one way of several that we teach in ancient Jewish wisdom of how to create your own future. Absolutely. Another one is to get rid of the tendency of being passive. And it's one of the terrible consequences of becoming an addicted television or video watcher, mm-hmm. is it turns you into more of a passive person. And again, a passive person doesn't create his own future. He just has the future thrust on him. And so by becoming an active person instead of a passive person, you also play a role in shaping your own future. And so that is a terribly important thing, that seeing the future is one thing. Playing a role in shaping and sculpting your own future could hardly be more important.
But how does one come up with a product or a service where you actually create the future? What sort of thinking, what sort of mindset, what do people need to be doing?
Well, I must tell you that in ancient Jewish wisdom, the idea that anybody can create anything in isolation is simply a myth and a fallacy. And this is one of the reasons that the whole, the Bible starts off with the story of the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve. In other words, the most creative thing that any human being can actually do is create another human being. Mm. As I'm sure Mr. and Mrs. Gates Sr. will tell you, that when they delivered an 8-pound blob of screaming protoplasm into the world called Bill Gates, it didn't occur to them that he would create a computer revolution. I mean, who has more shaped his future than that guy? And his parents only knew that they've just created a little baby. Well, that idea that the creation of another person takes two people to begin with is deeply implanted in Jewish culture. And that's one of the reasons that Jewish jokes, and again, you know that Jewish humor is a sort of a major part of Jewish culture. There's a whole genre of Jewish jokes about partners, business partners. And that's because it's very rare for Jews to go into business by themselves, because there's this recognition that true creativity requires more than one person involved. And so the idea, of the artist starving alone and creating these masterpieces all by himself, I just don't believe it. I just don't think it happens. And so the key to finding that the killer app or the killer product, interaction with other people. Enormous interaction with other people.
Okay.
Because it's through that conversation with others, through seeing others' lives, it's becoming part of the struggles and tribulations that others have, that needs become apparent. And fundamentally, that is the key to see everything in terms of not, oh, I'm so excited about this, but, wow, this could really help this group of people.
Now, using ancient Jewish wisdom, what can the past teach us to predict the future?
It's something that I think one of the American founders said as well, which is that we have very little to guide us forward with respect to people than their behavior in the past. Track record, very, very important. Mm-hmm. Not what people say. And this is, one of the extraordinary mistakes that people make in evaluating politicians. They listen to what politicians say. Not a mistake that Jewish culture lets you make in business. Looking at record, looking at the past, always very, very important. And then one of the things that helps you do, of course, is recognize the fluidity of the past. In other words, when is the past? Well, it's everything that's gone before. Was the past the horse buggies? Sure it was, but then it was also Model T Fords that Henry started making in the first years of the 20th century. And, what happened to the folks who were repairing buggy wheels and making buggy whips and horse harnesses and sweeping up horse manure from the streets of New York? Well, guess what? Things are changing. And so as you see yourself not as the self-important, self-focused spot in time, but you see yourself as a rowing boat on the river of time, you become accustomed to seeing that, hey, what is today isn't necessarily how it's going to be tomorrow, and what's going to be tomorrow is not how it's going to be the next day, and yesterday is very different from last week. And then when you start seeing things and you start training yourself to think of time in those ways, you're able to start much more effectively thinking about, okay, fine, how do I position myself in 2 months' time to be able to take maximum benefit of the way the river will be flowing at that point?
Another part of your book, you actually said that you encourage the reader that acting rich makes you rich. I thought we agreed that you should act your wage.
Yes.
So explain that to me.
So I think what we agree on is the conventional way of acting rich. Okay, and what is the advantage of acting rich? Obviously there's a motivation there. Obviously people do it, and there must be a reason, right? People will wear an expensive watch, or they'll wear expensive clothing, and what they're trying to do is telegraph to you that they're not in need. And one of the reasons for that is that human nature is to flee those in need, whether it's the homeless on the street or wherever. We turn our eyes. We don't like hanging out with those in need. And so we all, deep down on a subconscious level, understand that. So we try and project ourselves as being, shall we say, extremely comfortable, extremely affluent, because the idea is, well, that'll attract people to our orbit, both on a business level, on a social level, and yes, even on a romantic level.
Yeah, I mean, it helps you network, doesn't it?
It does.
Because rich people want to meet rich people.
And of course, one of the worries is when somebody tries to network with you and it's a very needy person, you think to yourself, he's going to drown me. He's going to fling his arms around my neck and cling to me. And so we all try and do that. The problem is that we spend in order to act rich. And ancient Jewish wisdom is filled with this idea that, yes, go ahead and act rich, but do it by what you give away, not by what you buy for yourself.
Do it by what you give away.
In other words, charitable giving carries within it all the advantages of the other approach. Charitable giving, number one, marks you as a giver, not a taker, and it associates you with other people who are also givers, which is exactly where you want to be, and it identifies you as somebody who doesn't cling tenaciously to his dollars, but he's willing to put them out there.
So you're less of a threat to the other person. You're less of a threat to the other person then.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, exactly.
And then you said also, one should never retire. And I agree with that because obviously, I guess the secret to living well in old age is having an active mind, even if the body, even if the body degenerates.
But the body degenerates more with people who've retired than who haven't.
That's just not the passage of time then.
So it's more than not the passage of time. I think what it is, look, I'll tell you, and I've always said this, music to my ears, and I hope this doesn't sound sort of silly and sentimental, but I think you know me well enough to know that if I'm speaking to you and, hundreds of thousands of our closest friends, I'm really going to tell the truth. The most beautiful sound to my ears are the words, "Daddy, come here, I need you."
Right.
And I dread the point of my children not needing me anymore. So being retired or retiring is essentially identifying yourself as somebody that no one needs anymore. And it's got to be a horrible thing. I mean, imagine you're a plumber, and every time people have a crisis with the water supply or the toilet or whatever it is at their house, they call you. You've got clients and customers who've been part of your life for decades, and then all of a sudden, July the 20th, you retire. July the 21st, you sit around and you realize nobody needs you.
No.
How awful must that be? And so, and even worse than that, retiring means that what you really are saying is that all along up till now, the whole thing was a sham. all along up till now, I thought you were in business to help other people and that the money was incidental. It came automatically, but that you weren't just doing it for the money. You were doing it because you got a thrill out of helping other people. And now I see that once you got enough in your bank account, you're quitting. You don't need anything anymore. That puts a lie to everything you were doing up till now. It's the same way that a bad follow-through can wreck a golf drive. In the same way, the theme of retirement sort of being part of your life. Oh, goody, only another 35 years to retirement. Oh, great, only another 20 years to retirement. That theme poisons your whole life. That bad follow-through to your career poisons everything you do up till this point.
And part of your book also, you sort of spent quite a bit on talking about talking to yourself verbally, laying out your goals, not just in your mind, but actually speaking it out in the quiet corner of your room or your house or whatever.
Yes, that's right.
What is why self-talk?
Well, the one of the key things in getting to know oneself is, and there are other ways of doing this. It just so happens that the Jewish way works really well, and the evidence is the very large number of Jews who are disproportionately good with money, and this is a part of it. Now, getting to know yourself means getting to recognize that there are two parts of each and every one of us. There's, if you like, the horse and the rider is the classically Jewish way of putting it. There's a part of me that is the sort of material energy source. It's the drive. It's the horse, but then there's also the driver. That's the human being on top of it. Now, a Martian coming to Earth for the first time and watching somebody ride a horse might well assume that this little figure on the back of the horse is at the mercy of this large, powerful creature underneath it, and he might say, "Oh, you know how sad that is. That poor little thing." That thing we call a human being has to just go wherever the horse wants to go, and he's just helpless. He has to sit on the back, no matter. And it takes somebody to say, "No, Mr. Martian, it doesn't work like that. In the real world, the rider directs the horse." So we have to ask ourselves, are we just a body that proceeds to do whatever it likes and the soul gets dragged along for the ride, or are we a soul that directs where the body's going to go? And talking to oneself is the way we have of treating yourself like the rider you are. In other words, you're talking to that part of you. By the way, this is exactly what coaches do in athletics, you know, where they have sessions before a big game or a big race or whatever it is, where they psych themselves up.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes sales professionals before an important call psych themselves up. And all I'm saying is that don't just think the thoughts you want to bring about. Say them, or better yet, write them down, because that helps this critical thing of strengthening the rider and making sure that the horse will follow his direction. In other words, that part of us which would rather linger and watch another TV show, or that part of us that just doesn't want to knock on another door, make another phone call, that part of us gets driven by the conscious soul part, by the rider on the horse. Does that make some sense?
It makes sense. I mean, it's. But does it have to be the same thing every day?
No, it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be, because then you're commoditizing yourself. It's like a salesman who greets every single person who walks onto the used car lot the same way. You know, it's not good for him. It's not good for business. It's not good for the customer. We have the law of I shall not commit adultery doesn't just mean that I can't treat other women the same way I treat my wife. It's that I can't treat any human beings exactly the same as any other human beings. My relationship with every person has to be absolutely unique and shaped and sculpted for that particular person.
Rabbi Daniel, we've come to the end of the show.
It
just flew by. I mean, I could have been speaking to you for much longer. I had so much more to ask you, but... Where can we get the book, Thou Shall Prosper?
Well, the website where they can at the very outset immediately read more about it, everyone should go to my website, which is youneedarabbi.com.
Okay.
Youneedarabbi.com. And you can read about and see the book there on my website. And alternatively, obviously, it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's available in stores. It's... It's happily widely available. It's not hard to get.
Toda rabba lacha, my friend. Come back soon.
Shalom, shalom, and thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, wise words that enrich us from one of America's most influential rabbis, and that was Rabbi Daniel Lapin. Thank you all for listening. Your comments and your follow are very welcome on my social media. A special shout-out of thanks to my wonderful team, William Sanchez and Rick Buser. I'll be back next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Until then, I wish you a wonderful evening tonight, and have a productive and a very happy week ahead.